Hello, welcome to The Addict's Advocate, a podcast geared towards the suffering addict and those in recovery. This podcast does not provide any medical advice. No material on this podcast is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Enjoy the show.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of The Addict's Advocate. I am your host, Dusty Dean, and I've got the pleasure here of having a good friend of mine on the podcast this evening, and her name is Sally. Hello, Sally. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too. So you and I have spent some time together in and out of group, learning the treatment techniques that we need in order to maintain a sober and a healthy lifestyle. And I was looking forward to having this conversation with you, so that way you can share what you found insightful, what's worked for you, what hasn't, what struggles, etc.
Sure.
Before we get into that, I think the best thing to do is let's talk about just a little bit of background on yourself. You know, how did you get to this point in your life where you realized you had a problem?
Okay, so I'm 66 now. I had kind of a little traumatic childhood. I wasn't physically abused or anything, but I was deprived of any contact. Basically, my mom kept me in the basement until I went to kindergarten. So I had to learn my own ways around. I even drew friends on the wall to play with. But so I just started finding my own way to make myself feel better, but I never felt better around people. So I found isolating ways. And so I call myself a serial addict because the very first addiction I realized I had was when I went to seventh grade and I became bulimic. Somebody told me about it and I just was bulimic for like 10 years. And then I went into, you know, cutting. I had to cut all the time because I just felt like that would release whatever was in me, which who knows what it was. And then if I ever did have a relationship, I would be addicted to that person. And then finally I found alcohol, and that was the best isolating mechanism I had. Nobody wants to be around you when you're always drunk.
How long did you were you battling with alcohol?
It was over 20 years that I was drinking. It got triggered, let's see, actually 2004 is when I started. I had gone through cancer, and one of the things is every other Thursday, I would get meds that would put me asleep for the whole till Monday because of the chemo would make me feel so sick. And that's when I noticed, wow, it is really good to just check out. So I survived cancer and everything, but then I still wanted to check out. So, you know, I'd go to work and then I'd come home and check out.
Wow. So, you know, we've, you know, in our group, we talked about these things that are kind of, you know, the circular issue with, you know, the medical and neurobiological side of addiction, right? Where trauma, right, affects dopamine receptors and
yes,
brings things down. And if, you know, if you've been dealing with trauma, you know, from an early age, obviously you've been fighting to try to find a way to feel okay and good about yourself for quite some
yeah
time. Your whole life, it sounds like.
That is why in the group, I was all over every time they went into anything neurological, biological. I wanted to figure out what is the mechanism. And then also I have a counselor that I see once a week that specializes in addiction. And she's the one that's helping me with piece together the trauma and learning new ways to just exist around other people. Because it's something that I hid from through addictions for my whole life.
Wow. You know, one of the things that I found that worked for me really well was kind of grieving those things in my life in an attempt to kind of let them go. right?
Yeah.
Letters, you know, but also just, you know, getting to a point of forgiveness, right?
Yeah. I think that is a fantastic idea. Where I'm at right now is my parents are 93 and 89, and my dad is mentally still there. But my mom, who was the primary abuser, has Alzheimer's. So every night I'm over there watching her forget we have an ice machine and trying to make ice. And it's just, so at this point I can't grieve. I know her background and I know why what happened. So I might get angry with her, but it'll be a while, because right now I just feel for her so much.
Yeah. No, I can appreciate that. It's still your parents, right? I mean, that's
yeah.
The end of the day.
And they actually did their best, just like I was an alcoholic, and I thought I did my best with my three kids.
Right. Yeah. You know, parenting is a delayed gratification, right? You never know until they're older and you find out. What, so over, you know, since 2004, I'm assuming it wasn't a drink till you passed out daily occurrence. It probably ramped up over time, correct?
Yeah, it did. I went from like half a bottle every single night. I mean, seriously, I don't think there were even one hand 5 days during 20 years that I didn't drink. But I was very disciplined about it. I only had drank one kind of wine because that would not give me a hangover. And I knew what to eat. And as soon as I got off work, then I would drink. I never went to work drunk. But by the end, the last couple of years, I was up to 2 bottles every single night. And so I don't even know whether I was sober when I went to work. I assumed I was, but I probably wasn't. And I was making mistake after mistake, and I totally trashed my reputation. And that was the only thing I thought I had done well. So that is what brought me to the intensive outpatient group. I pretty much had a nervous breakdown when nobody would hire me and I found out what my reputation was. I was devastated. And thank goodness my primary, who had been trying to get me in for the last 2 years, I called her just in tears, and she found the group that we were in, and she got me in there that day.
Well, that's wonderful. So I guess, yeah, it was all, that was probably your primary catalyst then, all right? You weren't willing to take a look at your drinking until you recognized what was happening in your life externally and how your perception, how you were perceived by others, things of that nature, huh?
Yeah, it's very shameful. And I could always kid myself that I was getting away with it until it was obvious I wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I was the same way. I thought that I had everybody fooled, and you know, I'm the sober looking drunk. Yeah, right. No, you're the drunk looking drunk is what you are. That's what I was getting. Your family, how has your family responded, you know, to your efforts to stay clean?
Okay. So first, my dad was an alcoholic through most of my childhood, but he was also an extremely successful person. The guy has 3 PhDs. And he never lost a job, but he would drink martinis every single night. And so he finally quit. I don't know how long ago, but he went to AA, and we lived in Seattle at that point. And he would go to an AA, 3 or 4 or 5 AA meetings every single day. And it was very important to him. Now, that was a little bit of a conflict with me because I did try AA, and I'm one of those people that went in every day saying I didn't drink and had drunk the night before. So AA was not working for me. I found a million excuses for it not to work. Oh, it's the people, it's the place, it's all that stuff. But my dad kept saying, you got to go to AA. And so the more he said I had to go to AA, the more I didn't go to AA. But now he's extremely supportive. He's still into an AA meeting, but he's doing great. The biggest difference are my 3 children, who I am blessed because all 3 of them love me to the moon and back. But for years, like a decade, they didn't really talk to me. Like I would get a text back or something, you know, they just, and even when they lived in the house, there was no conversation because they believed that I was choosing alcohol over them. And so why would they give me any time? They wouldn't be mean to me, but they just found their own way. And thank goodness none of them's gotten into trouble yet, knock on wood. They all seem to be really good kids. But now they're slowly, you know, talking to me, having conversations. The oldest one wants to, you know, help me learn how to garden. The youngest one is always asking me if I want to go for a walk. And the daughter who lives down in LA, who I am lucky if I see once a year, just sent me a text with her plane itinerary, just out of the moon, out of the, you know, blue moon, coming to visit me. So now I'm not saying that we have these great conversations. Those are still pretty quiet, you know, when we're sitting across from each other. But I can see that they are making an effort, and I have to meet them halfway by realizing they've got a lot of stuff that they lived through that I don't even remember. And so right, I have to respect their needing a little bit of like a safety space.
So. I understand. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the damage we do. That one of the things that was profound to me was I had someone in one of the classes I attended had said they realized that they were transferring their own pain to those people around them that they love.
Oh my God, that's powerful.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. What struggles have you found in trying to maintain sobriety?
Well, the hardest thing was, you know, I, as I said, a lot of my addiction was my hiding from any kind of relationship. And when I went into the IOP group, intense outpatient group, it was 3 nights a week, 3 hours a night, and with these people for 36 weeks. And it was intense. I mean, 36 meetings. It was so, so intense. And I just felt so connected to all of those people. I cared about every one of them, and they cared about me. And so when I left that, I didn't really have other friends, and it was very hard for me to then be accountable to myself, to not sit there and go, oh, I have 90 days, you know, to a group that people that would clap. You know, it was really hard, but the group did teach me, you know, coping skills, and I knew that not having people was one of my triggers. So I had a list of relapse prevention things. And a lot of it was talking through my counselor, realizing the world isn't all of a sudden good just because you're not drinking. My same issues, feeling insecure around other people and all that, that's still there. But now that I'm sober, and I had been sober for 3 months by that point, I realized, well, wait, I do have control. I can handle it different. I cannot make it worse, which was a unique thing. I always made it worse. And so I feel like that was the biggest step for me when I realized, you know, yeah, you're still going to be alone. You got to figure a way to deal with loneliness. Go make some friends, go online date, do something, but don't drink, because you'll go right back and you'll lose another 20 years of your life.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. With regards to your routine, obviously, because you've pulled alcohol out of the equation, what are your daily habits like? What are you finding yourself doing?
Okay, so I have to be very careful, because I was a very regimented drinker. It would start in the evening. I would get my food. I'd go crawl into my bed. I'd turn on Netflix and drink my wine and everything. So now I know I cannot watch Netflix at night, because even now it's like, okay, when I was in junior high, I was a competitive swimmer. And so I'd be swimming before school and after school. And still to this day, the smell of chlorine makes me famished. And so I realize if I watch Netflix in my bed at night, I'm going to want that wine. So I'm not where I can do that yet. Maybe someday I'll be able to do that, but that's my biggest challenge. So that's one thing. But then I have to fill the nighttime with other things. And so I've started making these seed bead on a loom bracelets and making bands, like an Indian Native American print, and sewing them on the bottom of jeans or jackets or things like that. And people, you know, I give them to friends and it makes me feel good. But the other thing that is very important to me now is I get up and I make my bed. I don't just crawl out of bed and maybe splash water on my face and brush my teeth. I take care of my environment. I make sure the kitchen's clean. I think about what I'm going to eat. I think about the exercise I need to get. And you know, if something's hurting, I go ahead and go to a chiropractor. I take care of me for once instead of just not taking care of me. And I'm valuing myself. So it also reinforces my not wanting to hurt myself by drinking.
I like that. That's nice. Yeah. No, self-care, right? It becomes a newfound reality, right? And with the time, right, you can sometimes the simplest of tasks are meditative, right? You get kind of lost in the simplest of things, but it helps the time go by, takes the mind off of any cravings. So that's awesome. Good for you.
Thank you.
As far as, you know, the sober community, I know that, you know, being removed from it, like you said, has been difficult. But do you still find that that it's obviously it's a tremendous anchor for you in maintaining your sobriety? Because you know you're not alone, right?
Yeah, I have come full circle. I really do feel like I need to get back into a group because I've been out of a group since I think the beginning of December is when I started not being in IOP. Now, I have seen my counselor once a week, and I do some online stuff two times a week. But I really need people, and so I'm going to start going to back to AA. I'm going to have an open mind and think these people are not all trying to get me to drink my wine.
Well, you know, there's so many opportunities now, right? With meetings and different times of day, different home groups.
You need a tribe that supports what you want to accomplish in life, which is sobriety.
Well, I found that here in my valley, I've had a couple of meetings. I went to, I'm like, no, not for me. And I found another one. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, this is good.
Good.
And yeah, and I think, you know, you put as much effort into it as you want. The biggest thing is, you know, that there's one rule, right, with all those, is that, you know, just don't use, you know, don't drink. Any surprising revelations with being sober that you just like, wow, you know, I didn't realize this, or I simply forgot this?
The biggest, it sounds so foreign to anyone who's not an addict, but to realize 20 years disappeared with me every day saying, tomorrow I won't drink. And 20 years, my kids growing up, all the things they did in school. I mean, it's just gone and I can't get it back, but I have to just realize that that's part of my relapse prevention plan, that sadness that I lost that time. And it doesn't make me want to drink. It makes me never want to drink, which is why I hold on to it.
You know, I think that there are a lot of people in this world that live life, you know, without addictions, but aren't truly present, right? And one of the blessings that this has given you is that you're truly present now of every day, right? So every day is that much richer. And I think that that's a blessing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Any like gems of wisdom that you want to share, you know, from your journey that you feel has been very profound for you, that is really just, it's kind of maybe a constant you go back to whenever you think about what you did and what you're doing now?
I think that for me personally, taking care of myself instead of feeling like I'm a bad person and I should be punished by overeating or drinking or, you know, all these things. Take care of me. That is, I just have, you know, like I've explained, there's a routine and I constantly am thinking, You know, I treat myself like a little baby. You know, this is this little girl that, you know, didn't get a lot of love. I'm just going to pour every bit of love I have in her and let her know she's good. And then I behave better.
You know, there's definitely, you know, self-worth, right? Yeah. I mean, we as addicts are inadvertently, you know, killing ourselves in one way, shape, or form, right?
Yes.
And also there's collateral damage with that. So yeah, so giving, you know, and because I think you can also guide somebody else too that maybe has you know, questionable self-worth and help raise them up as well, right?
Yeah.
You have that empathy, right? You have that empathy for someone else.
Yeah.
If you came across an addict tomorrow and you could just tell that they were addicts, and maybe they're not aware of it, or maybe they're aware of it but don't know how to free the chains, what would you say to them?
That if they weren't aware of it, I don't think I could do too much. But if they were aware of it and they were where I was 10 years ago, or, you know, any time during my addiction, I don't know whether I would have listened, but what I would want to say is it has to be your number one goal. My husband was a very successful athlete, and so he had a problem and he would not quit. And this was before my problem had really started. And I remember my father, who had stopped drinking, said, this has to be, your being sober has to be your number one priority in life. And he's like, no, I got this and this and this to do. It's too much money. I can't, you know, all, you know, his income would suffer and all of that. And my dad was like, you're never going to get sober unless it's your number one priority. And now he's dead. And I wish that he had just stopped and take and embrace that. And so that is where I'm at now. I embrace it. I'm 360 degrees of a person. There's all these great things about me, but one of them is, and that's not the great thing, is I'm an alcoholic. I have to make that my priority, not excluding the good things I am, but just always carrying it with me so that I don't get caught off of guard. Because if I got caught off guard, oh, I would hate to go back to where I was 5 months ago.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Sally, you know, I appreciate you sharing so much. I've learned a lot more about you than I've known before. And I'm sure that the listeners are going to enjoy your perspective and be appreciative of your perspective and your willingness to be raw. And so with that, I would like to thank you for your time, okay? And you have a wonderful rest of your day.
I want to thank you for doing this and giving me the opportunity to do it. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too.